KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning and welcome to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Addiction medicine is a medical subspecialty formally recognized since 1990, concerned with the prevention, evaluation, diagnosis, treatment, and recovery of persons with the disease of addiction, of those with substance-related health problems, and of people who show unhealthy use of substances. This could include nicotine, alcohol, gambling, internet, prescription medications, and other licit and illicit drugs. In 2016, the American Board of Medical Specialties, the ABMS, officially recognized addiction medicine as a medical subspecialty under the American Board of Preventive Medicine. This action emphasizes the importance of addiction medicine as a distinct subspecialty among other subspecialties in the field of medicine. Providence, Alaska has a new addiction medicine fellowship to focus on shifting the way people in Alaska can get care and access to resources. Treatment is provided via an interdisciplinary approach and includes a variety of clinicians. This is part of an overall culture change designed to get medical professionals to work together across inpatient and outpatient settings to benefit people recovering from addiction. Joining us today is addiction psychiatrist Dr. Ryan Wallace. Dr. Wallace is program director of the Alaska Addiction Medicine Fellowship and the medical director for the Breakthrough Substance Use Treatment Program at Providence, Alaska. If you have a question or a comment about addiction or addiction medicine, please give us a call toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Also joining us later in the program will be Dr. David Mendez, a family practice and addiction medicine physician. And I would also like to remind our listeners that this program will be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Dr. Wallace, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'd like to start by giving you an opportunity to let the listeners know a little bit about yourself, what brought you to Alaska, what got you interested in this specialty. Tell me about Dr. Wallace.
Well, so Dr. Wallace grew up in Montana, to start. So I grew up in Montana, and I think my interest in addiction really started then. We had a pretty significant problem with methamphetamine in my community, and we saw the consequences play out among our community members. So it was something that was kind of we grew up around. I went to medical school thinking I was going to do more internal medicine, and then started working with individuals with mental illness and was really drawn into the field of psychiatry. I actually did my psychiatry rotation up in Anchorage back in 2012 and fell in love with Alaska. So I always knew I would come back after training. So found psychiatry, did my psychiatry residency at Yale University. And one of the things that I bumped up into frequently there is that I just felt powerless when it came to helping my patients who were struggling with substances. And there was very little support for them, and I felt like I had very little knowledge of how to approach them and help guide their recovery. So I ended up doing an addiction psychiatry fellowship more just to get the tools. And then the getting into the addiction field just opened up so many doors on an individual level. It was amazing to work with people and actually see people recover and do well, some miraculous turnarounds in the field. But there's also an importance to be active on systems levels as well as with kind of public health. And that was another thing that really drew me to kind of stay in the addiction field. So I actually moved back up to Alaska in 2020. I was hired by Providence as there was such an interest and need among Providence and in our community for addictions to work with the team to develop the addiction fellowship here.
Great.
And so I've been here since then.
Well, welcome. We're happy to have you as part of the community. It's a much needed service. And I know that Providence is also with this fellowship program, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, you know, trying to expand services and have more providers to treat addiction. Let's start with what is addiction medicine. So it's both a very broad field, mm-hmm. but also focused in certain ways. So I summarized it a little bit above mm-hmm. with my opening, but do you have any differing thoughts or any clarifications on the, you know, what addiction medicine is?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting context. So it is, as you said, a newly recognized field, but it's not really a new field. It's actually been around for over 100 years. And I think the origins of addiction medicine influence kind of how we practice and navigate in our societies currently. So addiction medicine actually started in the 1800s and early 1900s. When opioids started becoming an issue in this country, right? They came over in the 1800s, and then physicians had ready access to these drugs. And so it was actually a disproportionate number of physicians that were developing addictions to opioids. And as a result, they would get kind of cast out from the medical community. But many of those individuals went into recovery. And as more and more physicians were going into recovery and kind of figuring out what it took to function and heal, after recovering from an addiction, this society, this community started forming. And that was really the beginnings of addiction medicine. It kind of started as a peer support group almost for physicians, and very much a grassroots kind of organization to provide support to this otherwise ostracized group of healers. And it stayed kind of on the outskirts of medicine because of the fact that it was people in recovery, and there's so much stigma about that, mm-hmm. That it took many years for it to kind of reassert itself in the public stage. Psychiatry actually was the main mantle bearer for addictions for many years and came up with the diagnosis, the diagnostic approaches and everything like that. And it was really in the past couple years where we've seen the public health need is so immense that it can't just be psychiatrists. And addiction medicine really sprung up to meet the public health need in our community. All physicians can become addiction medicine specialists, OBs, pediatricians, family docs. And I think that's really where the power of addiction medicine lies. And it retains its identity in the culture as a grassroots movement. So we're very outspoken in advocacy and changing policy and working with our leaders to improve our healthcare system's ability to support the people who need our support.
Yeah, that's a fantastic summary. Thank you, Dr. Wallace. I also want to introduce to our listeners Dr. David Mendez, who's joining us, a family practice and addiction medicine physician. Dr. Mendez, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. I wanted to give you a chance also to explain to our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to Alaska, what got you interested in addiction medicine.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Texas, and then I did my training in Colorado. So I did a family medicine residency and then did a fellowship in addiction medicine afterwards. And I have been interested in kind of mental health, behavioral health for a really long time. And it's one of the things that as I was choosing my career, I was kind of debating what I would do afterwards. And addiction is just something that I saw in every single rotation that I was in, all throughout residency. And it was an area where I saw a lot of need, and an area that I like really got a lot of fulfillment in working in. So during residency, I had a preceptor, a physician I worked with who worked in addiction, who it kind of became a mentor for me and really someone who I aspired to kind of be like them, I guess, at one point. I saw the fellowship as an opportunity to blend more mental health into what I do. And I made it up here because of this fellowship. Actually, I met Dr. Wallace and this addiction medicine fellowship, ability to teach more and work in a community that has a lot of need in it, and also for just a new sense of adventure.
Yeah. Well, welcome to Alaska. It's nice to have you here. I'm glad you stayed after fellowship. Let's talk a little bit about what training goes into becoming an addiction specialist. We'll start with Dr. Wallace here.
Yeah, so there's two different pathways to become an addiction specialist. The first is through psychiatry, and that's only open to psychiatrists where they can do an addiction psychiatry fellowship. And then the program we started up here is addiction medicine. And as I mentioned earlier, addiction medicine is open to all specialties. So people will go through a residency and get their family med training, or they'll get their internal med training. They'll see a need, they'll want to get more experience in addiction medicine, they'll do an addiction medicine fellowship. So both pathways are clinical programs. They're one-year training programs where our trainees do intensive substance use focused treatment in all the settings within our healthcare system. So they work in the hospital, they work outpatient, and then they work with community partners and get healthy didactic series as well. So.
Sure. And Dr. Mendez, you did the fellowship here, is that right?
No, I did my fellowship in Colorado.
Okay.
And then I worked there for a few years, and I came up when Dr. Wallace was mentioning to me that he was starting a fellowship up here, and I wanted to be a part of that. So I joined him up here to kind of also educate other people, other trainees here who are interested in addiction.
Excellent. So for the fellowship that you mentioned, it's a one-year program. After all, you know, you become a doctor and do residency and whatnot, whatever specialty. What makes the new training program that you guys created here kind of unique compared to maybe some programs down in the lower 48, Dr. Wallace?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is it's Alaska, and we have a really unique community up here. We have a diverse community. The healthcare system, I think, is a robust system for being such a unique geographic location. And so I think we are able to capitalize on the unique experiences and opportunities here. I think the other thing is that there hasn't been a large infrastructure for addiction med in Alaska. And to come here, you can be part of creating something, of building something, building a community that's not pre-established. And I think that's something that's appealed to me and Dr. Mendez, and appeals to the people who, you know, choose to come here for training, because the opportunities to make a difference and to make an impact are immense in Alaska and our community, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. And so does the fellowship involve rotating through, you mentioned different types of facilities, but also there's only so much involved with Providence, or does it also involve like public or government uses and private funds, or not private funds, private businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the unique things about the fellowship programs is it's a great way of breaking down silos. And the fellowship, we collaborate, so we do have rotations at Providence. Inpatient, outpatient, that's where both Dr. Mendez and myself work. Our trainees also go to the tribal health system. We collaborate with South Central Foundation, ANTHC. We've done some work with the DOC intermittently. And then we have people from community organizations like the 4As come give lectures to our trainees. And it's, you know, I think that's an important opportunity within graduate medical education to kind of bring people together and to build this community. But it's also a really great way to get the expertise that we're creating up here. We're kind of building our own supply of addiction docs up here, you know, out into the community to meet the need, not just at Providence, but everywhere in Alaska.
Yeah, no, I absolutely see that. You know, a lot of practitioners here get up through the military. That's how I came to Alaska. And not a lot of people will come up here unless they're incentivized to do so for some reason and then fall in love with it. And I think that's one thing the fellowship can do is, you know, living and breathing in Alaska for a year can expose you to what a wonderful place it is. I want to remind our listeners of our call-in numbers statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, or email me at line1@alaskapublic.org. We have a call from Amelia, calling from Eagle River. Amelia, welcome to Line 1.
Hey, yes, thanks for taking my call, doctors. And actually, the previous doctor just mentioned what I'm about to comment on, and that's just despite leading the nation when it comes to substance abuse per capita, we really don't have very many inpatient rehab facilities in this state. I know there's Ernie Turner, and that's geared more towards Native Alaskans. And there's a new treatment center in Wasilla, through Banyan, and that's geared more towards veterans. But other than that, there's really no real inpatient treatment facility, and that makes people who want help have to leave the state for an inpatient bed. And, of course, those two places have pretty limited beds. So I just thought I'd pass that by you and see if there's anything in the works now that we have. I'm really happy we have this fellowship opening up, so there's more opportunities for those seeking help to get it. But if anybody knows of anything on the horizon to try to increase beds for those who are willing to get help.
Thank you, Amelia. That's a wonderful comment, and we definitely see that there are several services, or many services, that are lacking in Alaska. This is one of them. We will go into the different levels of treatment later on in the show, but Dr. Wallace, any comments for Amelia on the inpatient facilities availability in Alaska?
I mean, I agree. I think that it's a huge need up here. You know, one thing about the fellowship is we are creating expertise and competency in the state. It's going to take time until we're able to build up the infrastructure around our providers here to meet the needs. And I think inpatient rehabs in particular are in very short supply. One thing that we've, you know, and of course it's an important barrier to have to go out of state, right? That's a huge issue and prevents a lot of people from getting the treatment that they need and want. One thing that we are trying to do as much as we can now, and we'll talk more about the levels of care later, but is we try and support people as best we can from the outpatient setting and provide more supports in those settings so that we can maybe divert some people from the inpatient setting if they're unable to access that. But ultimately, it's something that we desperately need here, and I hope that, you know, there will be more resources soon.
Yeah. Dr. Mendez, do you know of anything coming down the line, or have you, what's been your experience with inpatient rotations and things?
Yeah, so right now I only work on the inpatient side, seeing people who are usually admitted for some medical reason, and, you know, we identify a substance use disorder. It has been challenging navigating the residential facility landscape. There are some facilities in different parts of the state, and sometimes you can find some information if you Google substance use disorder facility on the Alaska Gov website. You can actually find a list of all the facilities in the state, and if it's male, female, pregnancy, that sort of stuff. And you're able to find a lot more information on there, and that's been actually a really useful website for me. I know True North in Wasilla has been doing a lot. They're a Medicaid-only facility, and they do, I believe they started doing detox as well, and I think they're expanding as well. Aside from that, I'm not too sure about any others, but if you go to that website, you can find a list of the different facilities in the state.
And so your work is when people like are admitted to the hospital, the Providence Hospital specifically, mm-hmm. with, like, let's say they get in a car accident, or they're there for some other reason, but they also have been identified as having an addiction or maybe a substance use dependence thing. Mm-hmm. That's when you're called to sort of work with them?
Yeah, exactly. So if someone's starting to have withdrawal symptoms, or a test pops up negative, or something's coming up that people are concerned about an addiction or a substance use disorder, sometimes it's the patient themselves, or sometimes it's a significant other or a family member that's also in the room, where I'll try to help navigate and coordinate their care so that they can access care. But it's all on the inpatient side, yeah.
Yeah, so you must run into issues with a disposition and patients leaving the hospital. Okay, now their gallbladder's been removed, or their broken leg is fixed, but they have this alcohol dependence. Mm-hmm. You know, is it challenging to navigate where patients go after they leave the hospital?
It can be challenging in different ways, because people are admitted not for their substance use. They're admitted for a medical reason, and sometimes it's like, well, you know, it catches them by surprise sometimes. But it does give people a chance to have a conversation, you know, with me, and start to figure out, like, is this a problem or not? And if it is, you know, what can we do about it? Maybe it's still early on. Maybe it's not a full, like, a severe substance use disorder, but maybe it's on the milder side, and it's a chance to actually engage in outpatient services or do something less intense, so that we prevent it from becoming a bigger problem. And then for those folks who maybe it is much more of a problem, maybe they don't have that insight yet into seeing that it's actually a problem and how it's affecting their life. So we start to have those conversations initially to help coordinate their care after they leave the hospital, because that's kind of where, you know, in the hospital, we can only do so much. really a lot of like the recovery and everything happens after they leave. So getting them connected to a program, outpatient or inpatient, if that's kind of what their interest is one of the important things I think I try and do for all of the people that I see.
Great, great. Well, thank you for doing that. We're going to take our short mid-break. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guests today, give us a call statewide, toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, it's 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on addiction medicine with psychiatrist Dr. Ryan Wallace and addiction medicine physician Dr. David Mendez.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Thanks for listening today. We love being a part of your media mix. Tune in every day to catch the best in statewide news and programming.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by addiction psychiatrist, Dr. Ryan Wallace, and addiction medicine physician, Dr. David Mendez. And we're discussing addiction medicine. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So I'd like to talk about addiction more of in a general sense and learn a little bit more about addiction. So how do you define addiction? What defines being addicted to something?
If you look at the, you know, professional society's definition of addiction, they'll define it as a treatable chronic medical condition that entails compulsive use and continued use despite harms. And those harms can be to relationships, it can be to professions, it can be legal consequences, financial consequences. So it's that compulsive use. And what that looks like clinically, and I think this is a helpful way to kind of think about substance use generally, is that people, when they start using a substance, it feels really good. And naturally, they're going to want to use it again. As that happens more frequently, it gets to the point where they can't not use. And now they're not using to feel good, they're just using to not feel sick. Right, and that's the acute withdrawal that can develop when people become using substances regularly. And so addiction is that. It's that biological process, but I think it's also much more than that. It's also can be kind of defined as a social illness as well. I think if you look at our institutions and systemic racism in our communities, there's certain populations that are ostracized and disenfranchised, and I think made vulnerable to development of addictions as well. So I think it's an individual process. It's also a collective process and something that we all share ownership and accountability for.
Yeah, it's real interesting. A lot of people, they get a lot of blame. You know, it's like, using marijuana every day. Okay, where is the transition from just general use to addiction? Is it a choice? I mean, so Dr. Mendez, when I hear someone say, well, oh, they just need to stop drinking alcohol. I mean, it's a little bit more complex than just making that decision, right? What do you find is the issue with addiction, or where's the transition from where it becomes an addiction?
Yeah. You know, I think with any sort of behavioral change, any sort of, you know, if we just look at just general habits, those can be really challenging for any of us to change. You know, if we think about like kind of lifestyle changes, you know, those can be really hard for us to incorporate into our own lives. And with addiction or substance use disorders, there's other layers involved as well. If we think about a person like psychosocially, about their childhood, how they grew up, the type of like parenting that was involved, any other substance use, if addiction has been in their family for a really long time, because there can be a genetic predisposition as well to develop a substance use disorder. So there's just multiple other layers on top of just a behavioral change, which in itself is challenging for any person. So you add on these layers of trauma, mental health, its involvement in other aspects of their life or family, you know, so it becomes very, very challenging to kind of just stop. And then the dependency piece of it, like Dr. Wallace was mentioning, going in and out of withdrawal and, you know, not wanting to experience withdrawal, that can be a really big reinforcer to continue using, because you just don't want to feel sick. You want to feel normal. People transition from going to using for euphoria or to numb or maybe not to remember things that they don't want to remember, to just trying to feel normal. And then you get stuck in this cycle. So, it's a behavioral part of it, but then there's all these other layers involved with it as well.
Yeah, at some point it stops being just a choice. You know, it's a physiologic response to whatever the stimulus is. Mm-hmm. And so, let's talk a little bit about the factors that contribute to addiction. We mentioned genetics, Dr. Wallace. Like, what do you see in patients, or how do you counsel your patients about genetics playing a role in their addiction?
Yeah, I mean, we know that genetics probably play 40 to 50% of the, you know, they predispose people 40 to 50% of the risk for development of an addiction. And that's one piece of the bigger puzzle, right? So genetics play a huge role. But if I have a genetic predisposition to develop like a cocaine use disorder, if I don't come across cocaine, if I don't use cocaine, if I don't have other trauma in my experiences that make me more likely to continually use cocaine, I won't develop a cocaine use disorder. So the genetics is like an important piece of the puzzle, but it's just a small piece of the puzzle too.
Okay. And what about things like brain chemistry? Does that have any impact in susceptibility to addiction? We can start with Dr. Mendez.
I mean, yeah, definitely. I think especially because we see it in like other mood disorders, things like depression or anxiety, you know, you see changes in neurotransmitters, and sometimes having what we call like co-occurring mental health disorders, that can contribute as well to developing a substance use disorder. So yeah, definitely.
We have a call. Stu is calling from the Muldoon area. Stu, welcome to Line 1.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Simple question, guys. I know it's been asked 1,000 times before, but we got a state situation here where marijuana samples are free, coupons are on the way, are already free. Of course, they don't allow it in Anchorage yet. We got marijuana shops opening up, trying to open up all over Muldoon, and you saw what happened on the Parks Highway heading north. Guys, is marijuana legalization contributing to more people getting addicted to other harder things? I'm hearing 20% users end up moving on to harder stuff, and then we have problems even worse. Could you please address that issue? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Stu. We'll have you take your answer off air. Complicated question. And so I'd like both of you guys to weigh in on this. It's interesting, you know, back when I was a kid, it was always, you know, oh, that's a gateway drug, right? That was always the term that was used in the DARE program that I went through when I was younger. And obviously, society and culture has shifted a lot in the last 30 years since I was in those programs, you know, about the acceptance of marijuana use in you know, the legality of it and whatnot. So, complicated question. Let's try to do the best we can for Stu, but who wants to take this first? Dr. Wallace, I'm making you do it.
All right. You're going to have to help me, Dr. Mendez.
I will try my best.
So, I mean, the first thing I'll say is that cannabis, like any substance, has risks with it. Okay, so no substance is without risk. Very little actions in this world are without risk. Driving a car has risks. So I think cannabis as a separate issue, you know, there's a lot to unpack with that. You know, the, you know, cannabis serving as a gateway drug has, you know, it's not as simple as that, and that has not held up over the years. Cannabis is not a gateway drug. It's all those factors that we've talked about, the childhood experiences, the trauma people experience, the genetic predispositions, the you know, challenges in education and medical and psychiatric comorbidities. It's all these things that contribute to someone's risk to use any substance. And once they, you know, and they're at higher risk of using other substances as well. So I think, you know, cannabis can certainly be harmful. And using cannabis may expose people to other substances, but cannabis as a mechanism for using other, or as a kind of a gateway drug, is not commonly held to be accurate these days.
Dr. Mendez, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I agree with what Dr. Wallace is saying. I think, you know, it is much more of a complex issue. You know, I think it depends on exposure, you know, like what is the intention of using cannabis maybe at a young age? What else is going on in someone's life? You know, are they having a difficult, like a household experience, you know? Are there things happening at school or as an adult, you know, what else is going on in your life? Are you using this to numb or to not be present in life, to dissociate in a way from your experience of life? And I think, but you can use any other substance like that. And cannabis is also nuanced because cannabis is different now than what it was years ago. Now that we have dispensaries and more concentrated cannabis and higher levels of THC in cannabis now. So it is a different product that people are using. And I think it's good to know that it is different and it does come with risks as well.
Yeah, and I'd be interested in the devil's advocate position of, like, you know, people have always used marijuana, whether it was legal or not. And the fact that it's legal and you can walk into a store and you can buy it, now you're not exposing yourself to maybe someone who is selling this on the black market and also selling other drugs.
Exactly.
And things like that. So maybe in that respect, it kind of lowers the use of other medication or lowers the exposure to it.
Exactly, and it helps, you know, reduce what is in it as well, you know, because we are seeing fentanyl contamination and cocaine and methamphetamine, and it helps kind of having it in a dispensary does reduce the potential contamination.
Yeah, we have another call, Alex in Anchorage. Alex, welcome to Line One.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I was listening, and the question of whether marijuana is a gateway drug has kind of a personal connection to me, because I grew up, I did smoke marijuana, and that was kind of a peer pressure type situation along with alcohol and cigarettes. But I ended up using other drugs, but it was not because I used marijuana. It was because I was in the, you know, the criminal underworld of the drug, you know, the drug scene in the town. And so my exposure to the other drugs was not because of the use of marijuana, but because of the requirement of going through criminals to get that marijuana.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. So that kind of confirms my curiosity a little bit there. Did you have any other questions for us, Alex, while you're here? Anything about legal issues or anything?
Well, I don't really have any questions. I just kind of wanted to weigh in as somebody that's been through this. I would say that I'm an ex-heroin addict myself. I've been clean for about 16 years now.
Mm, congratulations.
I've been clean from alcohol for about 6 years. I currently use marijuana, but it is something that helps me with anxiety, stomach issues, things like that. I don't experience the same consequences that I did from other more physically addictive drugs.
That's a very interesting interesting topic. So thank you, Alex. Thank you for the call. I really appreciate that. Dr. Wallace, so what Alex said there at the end is actually quite interesting, that, you know, he's sober from alcohol and former heroin user, but clean for 16 years, but still uses marijuana. So how do you see this in your patient population? do you counsel people to like complete abstinence from all substances, or, you know, what's the interplay there?
It's important to take a patient-centered approach with all these things. So my goal is to help the patient achieve what their goal is. I think historically we've been very focused on abstinence. You know, the right answer, the success, is just not using. The reality is that's not the approach for everyone. So the approach we take now is to support people in achieving their goals. If their goals are abstinence, then great. We can help them get there. If their goals are to use the substance with less consequences, in as much as we can support them, we do that, right? That's kind of the harm reduction field, where people can get clean syringes if they're injecting, so they reduce their risk of getting HIV, Hep C. You know, and if people are wanting to use other substances and just want to be monitored on if there's going to be a consequence, we can help kind of track that too with people. So if someone's using cannabis and they're like, oh, I don't know if this is going to be good for me or not, we can kind of join them and meet them and talk to them about it over time. And see how it evolves. And that's something that I think is very liberating about addiction medicine, is we don't have to tell people what to do. You know, we're just here to kind of support people in improving their health and kind of achieving what their goals are. So success is what the patient wants.
Yeah. Dr. Mendez, anything to add for Alex?
Yeah, you know, I think this brings up for me the difference between dependency and addiction. We talk about this a lot in our field because some of the medications that we use, like Suboxone and Methadone, does create some dependency for a person, but that doesn't mean that you have an addiction to the medication. Kind of like we were mentioning earlier, if we think about kind of the behavioral components that we see when someone is in active addiction, like harm to self or maybe some harmful, like in relationships or things like that, you know, in the medications that we're using, you know, we see the dependency piece of it there, but the all the other aspects of addiction, the behavioral components of those are not present. And I think that's a really important distinction to make.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. So why would someone want to see an addiction physician specifically? And Dr. Mendez, I'll start with you, because you know, a lot of people might go to their general practitioner. You're also a family medicine doctor. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what is it about an addiction specialist that may sway someone to see an addiction specialist over a general practitioner?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've thought about it a little bit too, because, you know, especially like one of the main medications we use is Suboxone, right? And more recently, within the past year, anyone can prescribe Suboxone. You don't need any sort of special like license or anything like that. Anyone can do it, which is great. It expands access and things like that. But it got to me thinking, you know, why would you want to see someone who's specialized in addiction? And I think for me, what was really helpful for my fellowship and my training, and now what I do now, is that I think for us, we just get a little bit more training on like the psychiatry aspect that, you know, Dr. Wallace experienced during his residency. So feeling more comfortable with kind of co-occurring mental health, mood disorders like depression, anxiety, PTSD, things like that. And I think it really is just in like the style of interview, you know, what questions we're asking, what things we're looking for, especially if someone, you know, is trying to be in recovery, you know, things that we're looking out for, things that we're talking about. We do try to be very person-centered when we see someone. So I think kind of for those reasons, maybe seeking out an addiction med physician could be helpful.
Yeah, Dr. Wallace, I'd like your input on this. I mean, a buzzword that is very common these days in learning is like social determinants and health and things like that. Do you feel like your fellowship participants and addiction medicine colleagues have a better handle on that sort of stuff than maybe a general practitioner, or what's the goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, first of all, I think if someone is experiencing issues with substances, they should talk to their primary care provider. Period, that they should have a conversation. I think where the specialist comes in, as Dr. Mendez was saying, is when there's kind of overlapping or complicating factors, where we have extra expertise. How do you treat stimulant use disorder and ADD, for example? So I think that's kind of where we come into play. I do think that, you know, we spend our time in this world, we build connections with the community out of necessity, right? So Dr. Mendez is constantly finding rehab programs for patients to go to. And so I think we do have a better general knowledge about kind of resources that are available to people. And then we also have a finger on the pulse of what's happening in the drug supply as well. So we have a very unsafe drug supply right now in Anchorage and in Alaska generally. It's why we are seeing the overdose deaths we are. And you know, our patients talk to us about this, so we can provide guidance to people when they come see us about the trank that's now in the supply and things like that. So I think that's another thing that the addiction med specialist can provide that the general practitioner can't, but my hope would be that most people could be treated by a general practitioner. I think the comfort is not there yet among primary care providers.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guests today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on addiction medicine with addiction psychiatrist Dr. Ryan Wallace and addiction medicine physician Dr. David Mendez.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by addiction psychiatrist, Dr. Ryan Wallace, and addiction medicine physician, Dr. David Mendez, and we are discussing addiction medicine. If you have a question, call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So I do want to ask you guys, doing research for this program, you know, there's lots of addictions out there. Obviously, there's illicit drugs, there's prescription medications, smoking, alcohol, gambling, internet, sex, food, so much amazing stuff to talk about. Do you have kind of a favorite, it's a weird question, but like, or something that you enjoy working with people, or maybe something you don't see very often that really piques your interest? So I'll start with you, Dr. Wallace.
Of course you'll start with me. Thank you. I think the most rewarding, I think any addiction can be, you know, treating anyone can be incredibly rewarding. I think one of the things that I've noticed the most dramatic shifts in people's functional kind of functionality amidst an addiction is at the overlap between like a methamphetamine use disorder or a cocaine use disorder and ADHD. So these are people who have ADD and need stimulants to treat their ADD, but then they developed the compulsive use of stimulants on top of that. And it's an incredibly challenging kind of overlay for people to navigate. But when it's done successfully with the right supports and the right medications, the turnarounds I've seen in people's quality of life is just remarkable. I've seen more among that kind of subset, more change in a shorter amount of time than I have, I think, in other types of addiction. So I think for that reason, you know, it's something that is maybe something that is daunting to try and treat regularly, but also incredibly rewarding to treat.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Dr. Mendez, how about you?
Yeah, I enjoy working with the spectrum of substances, but I think really the stage, like if I'm thinking about the people that I work with, I really enjoy working with people who are ambivalent and who are able to just engage in a conversation, but there's ambivalence around it. And I really enjoy having those conversations and helping people navigate through that. And sometimes you can navigate them past ambivalence to like, you know, developing some insight, but sometimes not. And I really enjoy seeing people like regularly for that and seeing if we can help move them past ambivalence. But yeah, that's probably one of my favorite things.
So that's super interesting. So by ambivalent, do you mean like they recognize that they use a substance and they know why they use it, but they don't think it's a problem?
Well, they can see some of the problems, but not enough to necessarily make a change. You can kind of see both of them. You can see the positives, you can see the negatives, you're able to hold both of them. But the negatives of using don't outweigh the positives yet. You know, there's no reason to like necessarily have a change yet. But I think helping someone navigate that and helping them weigh out and hopefully getting them to that place of like, helping them have a change in behavior, but you know, ultimately it's going to be up to the person themselves, right, to be ready to make that change. But I just really like that kind of helping a person develop insight during that change. I feel like there can be a lot of power there, especially on the inpatient side where I do see a lot of ambivalence. And once you start helping them develop some insight, you can really start to see a lot of changes in someone's life.
Yeah, yeah. We have a call from Bob in Anchorage. Bob, welcome to Line 1.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
Let me get off my exercise bike here. Is there such a thing as positive addiction?
Positive addiction.
And if so, is there typically, or exercise being an example, and is there withdrawal? For example, if you get smoky forest fire conditions and it's really less than healthy to run, but people do anyway because they have a habit. Does that qualify as an addiction? And if so, how does it differ from pharmacological addictions?
Yeah, Bob, great question. That's super interesting. All these thoughts running around in my mind. Thank you. I'll have you take the answer off air. But so by positive, he means, you know, something that is generally maybe considered healthy, such as exercise. But obviously, you can overdo it, or it could become a compulsion. You know, so I don't know. What are your thoughts? I'll start with you, Dr. Mendez, because I always go to Dr. Wallace. But you know, how would you counsel someone on a quote unquote positive addiction? Is it an addiction? How do you define it?
I wouldn't consider that an addiction necessarily, but I would be curious about it. You know, like what? Why? You know, like are you trying to? Is it having any sort of negative effect on your life? You know, are you not like taking care of your work or housework or whatever? Or is it interfering in certain areas, or is it being unhealthy towards your body? And then if it's like, if it's a lot, then it's like, why? What's the purpose of it? You know, is it a distraction? Are you trying to ignore something else? Is there something going on in your life that you don't necessarily want to think about that you're trying to just push aside, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd be just more curious about the intention behind it.
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, you can get high from exercise. You get those endorphins going and it feels amazing, you know, and it's probably a great alternative to using substances. So Dr. Wallace, what are your thoughts on the matter? Like is a compulsion different than addiction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first, I love that Bob asked that question from his exercise bike. So kudos to you, Bob. So I think I agree with Dr. Mendez. I mean, I feel like there can be, it's a very fine line and it's tough to tease out. And I think, you know, in terms of like the example you gave about smoke and the atmosphere and things like that, I mean, I think that's a you know, minimal risk, you know, for things like that. You could also, but I think if it's starting to interfere with other things that you would typically enjoy doing, like that's where we see an addiction, right? Like with internet addictions or gambling addictions, that can be pleasurable to people and it can be totally okay. Substance use can be totally okay for some people. They can use substances and not run into any problems. But it's when it gets into that compulsive, there's consequences and they can't stop, that it becomes an issue. So if you're exercising and losing too much weight, or if you're, you know, alienating your friends and family because of exercise or something like that, I think that's where it is. So I think saying the term positive addiction, I understand what's being conveyed, but I don't think those two words actually go together. There can be maybe, you know, constructive borderline compulsive behaviors, but that doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well. So.
Okay. And Todd, we have a call. Todd in Anchorage, welcome to Line 1.
Thanks, guys. A little drift over here from your topic, which is excellent to expand the whole ideas that you're getting at. But, you know, Oregon has had this humongous experiment with liberalization and decriminalization of all substances, basically. And you hear every now and then a little snippet about the progress or impacts and what's going on. Do you guys, being in the field, have any insights recently into how that's shaking out, good, bad, in between, you know, anything you have to offer.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for the call. We really appreciate it. It's an interesting question. You know, decriminalization, is it positive in certain ways? Have we seen negative consequences of it? We'll go back to Dr. Wallace first here.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a great question. I think that there's, you know, no question that there are potential benefits to public health through decriminalization and legalization, right? One of the reasons people are overdosing on substances in our community now is because they don't know what they're taking. And with legalization, you can safely, you know, sell those substances and people will know what they're taking so they could accurately dose themselves. So there's benefits to legalization. There's benefits to decriminalization because we're not punishing people for a medical illness. We're maybe instead getting them treatments. You know, looking at some of the case studies we have for decriminalization, Portugal is another example where they did this many years back, and there's some interesting outcome data from that. But it's hard to do well, and I think what Oregon found is that you know, they had to backtrack a bit after their efforts for legalization because there were consequences and there was a lack of infrastructure to really support doing it correctly. You know, I, you know, all things being equal, think we would be much better off if there was a safer drug supply and if there were supports for treatments as opposed to punishments. But I do think it takes an immense amount of thought and coordination to do it well. And frankly, I'm not sure we've seen it done well yet, certainly in our country.
Yeah, it's sort of a law of unintended consequences, right? You change one thing and things happen that you don't foresee, for sure. Dr. Mendez, any comments about decriminalization and consequences?
Yeah, you know, I think this is another kind of nuanced sort of question. And I think that, I mean, there's definitely a lot of harms from criminalizing substance use. And I don't think the criminal justice system is necessarily going anywhere. And I also think that if we're going to continue kind of on the same path of criminalizing some of these substances, then we have to incorporate treatment. We have to incorporate rehabilitation, and we have to incorporate like medications that are going to be helpful for people. So if the goal is, you know, putting someone into jail or prison and then having them and then thinking that they're going to be okay coming out without incorporating anything else, then I think we're doing a disservice to people. So I think it's really important to make sure that we're giving people the help that they need so that when they do get out, they're more successful instead of keeping them in that same loop of using and being in jail or prison and kind of all the negative feedback loop, essentially.
Yeah. So another thought is, how do you deal with an addiction to something that is really kind of required for your daily use? And food is an obvious one, and there are a lot of food addiction specialists. So I don't necessarily want you to get too far into food, but let's talk maybe something like the internet. It's so hard to live your life without use of the internet. And so what, you know, what is an internet addiction? I'm charting all day long. I am on the internet. It's cloud-based. I'm looking up this and that and buying this and whatever. Like, how do you know what's when you're addicted to the internet? So, Dr. Mendez, you're first on this one.
I think that's also a really tough question because the internet is such a significant part of all of our lives. And I also do think it takes having some insight into yourself and being kind of true to yourself, I guess, as to like how much of a, is this a problem or not? You know, are you using it to like cover up emotions that are hard? Are you having negative effects on like for yourself? Kind of some of the similar sort of things that we see in addiction. I think in addiction to a substance, I think it can just kind of be a little bit more challenging to identify because it is such a pervasive thing in all of our lives. But I found it helpful to kind of, if you're going to log on to like Instagram or Facebook or X or whatever, any sort of platform, you know, like having a check beforehand, you know, like, why am I pressing this button? You know, what am I hoping to get out of this? Like, how do I feel right now? And then afterwards, like, how do I feel afterwards? You know, and if you find yourself in this loop of like feeling badly
and then like feeling badly again, you know, when you're kind of using this as a way of distracting something, then I don't know, maybe take a step back and figure out kind of how you're engaging with technology.
Yeah, you mentioned social media. It's an interesting one. As, you know, a father of teenage daughters, I struggle with social media so much, and the amount of time that they are on it is just staggering. You know, Dr. Wallace, any thoughts on internet or any addiction where you kind of, you know, have to be around the substance?
Yeah, I mean, this is new, right? So we waffle on answering this question because we don't know in the field. We don't actually have a defined internet addiction, you know, in our field currently. We're figuring this out. And I think as we get more and more dependent and we notice the reinforcement we all get from using social media and the way social media platforms leverage reinforcement to get people to come back, I think we're kind of understanding the magnitude of the problem more. You know, I think there is as a psychiatrist, I see a lot of isolation and sadness and depression the more and more people get hooked onto their phones. And so I think it's just an important thing for us all to kind of be aware of. And there's tools, there's apps like Freedom where you can like set limits on how much you access certain programs and certain apps. And just being aware of like when you get off your phone, do you feel drained or do you feel like your cup has been filled, right? And just kind of trying to set some of those boundaries in place. Like I'm trying to do that now, right? Because I, like you, spend all my time on a computer, you know, charting and sending emails. And I think we're learning kind of what that takes away from us too now. And I think the field will probably get more involved with it over time. And hopefully we'll know more about it and how to live healthy, interconnected lives. Yeah. Moving forward. So.
Well, we only have about under 2 minutes here, and a couple of calls. I'm sorry we're not going to get to all of these. But I wanted to give you guys an opportunity for the last minute or so each to any closing thoughts, any thoughts for our listeners about addiction, or if they're having issues, like how do they get in contact with someone? So, Dr. Wallace.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us, and thank you everyone who's listened to the program. You know, to your latter point, Dr. Clark, I think if there's anyone that's listening who you know is struggling with substance use or worried that they may be struggling with substance use, I would just encourage you to seek help. Either ask your primary care doctor, go to a peer support group like Alcoholics Anonymous, Dharma Recovery, Smart Recovery. There's so many organizations in the community that can provide support and guide you in the right direction. There is hope and support out here, so just ask for it, and hopefully we'll be able to meet up at some point. But and hopefully as a society we're moving in the right direction where people can be more supported in their substance use and recovery.
Thank you. And Dr. Mendez, the last 30 seconds or so.
Yeah, you know, just, you know, there is help out there, kind of like Dr. Wallace was saying, and there is hope. You know, sometimes when people are deep in a cycle of addiction, it can feel really hopeless that they can ever have a change in their life. But there are options, and there is hope to feel better.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's all we're going to have time for today. I really want to special thanks to our guests for being with us today, addiction psychiatrist Dr. Ryan Wallace and addiction medicine physician Dr. David Mendez. Great show. I could keep going for a whole nother hour with all of these topics, but I want to also say thank you to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. This program will also be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation, operating the Fleets, Inn Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset, starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, gale warning tonight. Today, southeast winds 15 knots, becoming northeast 25 in the afternoon, sea 6 feet. Tonight, north